Quran leads the way to science. This program is based on the book, The Quran Leads the Way to Science, by Harun Yahya. God summons humanity to investigate and reflect upon the heavens, the earth, plants, animals, the creation of man, and many other created things. Examining these, man comes to recognize the artistry of God's creation in the world around him, and ultimately to know his Creator, who created the entire universe. Science offers a method by which the universe and all the beings therein may be examined to discover the artistry in God's creation, thereby communicating it to mankind. Religion, therefore, encourages science, adopting it as a tool by which to study the subtleties of God's creation. Religion is the only source to provide accurate and definitive answers as to how life and the universe came into being. As such, if initiated upon a proper foundation, research will reveal the fact of creation. It will reveal the truths regarding the origin of the universe and the organization of life in the shortest time and with minimum effort and energy. As stated by Albert Einstein, science without religion is lame, which is to say that science, unguided by religion, cannot proceed correctly. This fact is obvious with several examples. Science pursued by materialist scientists has, particularly in the last 200 years, certainly caused a considerable amount of time to be squandered. It has caused a great deal of research to be pursued in vain, and millions of dollars to have been poured down the drain to no effect. There is one fact that must be recognized clearly. Science can achieve reliable results only if it adopts as its main objective the investigation of the signs of creation in the universe and strives solely towards this end. This is the only way to benefit from science. Islam is the religion of reason and conscience. A person recognizes the truth proclaimed by religion through the use of his wisdom, but derives conclusions from the truth he has seen by following his conscience. Surah Al-Imran, verse 191, refers to such people in the following manner. Those who remember God, standing, sitting, and lying on their sides, and reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. Our Lord, you have not created this for nothing. Glory be to you. So safeguard us from the punishment of the fire. In the Quran, God calls on people to reflect upon and examine the signs of creation around them. Everyone who probes these signs and investigates them will come to know God's superior wisdom, knowledge, and eternal power. God summons mankind to study and examine various aspects of the world, such as the heavens, rain, plants, animals, birth, and geographical landmarks. The way to explore these is, as we previously mentioned, through science. Scientific observation introduces man to the mysteries of creation and ultimately to God's eternal knowledge, wisdom, and power. It is for this reason that throughout history, a great number of the scientists who have been of great service to humanity were devout believers in God. Those who use their reason and follow their conscience in the pursuit of scientific research apprehend God's signs at close hand. They are confronted with a flawless system and a perfect subtlety created by God in every avenue of research they follow and in every discovery they make. Therefore, they acquire a strong faith. For instance, It is enough for a scientist conducting research into the eye to recognize its complex system. He immediately discovers that it could never have come into being through a gradual process of coincidences. Further examination will lead him to realize that every detail in the structure of the eye is a miraculous creation. He sees that the eye is made up of dozens of components working together in harmony, thus increasing his wonder in God who created it. Similarly, a scientist investigating the cosmos will find himself immediately confronted with thousands of remarkable equilibria. He further gains a great thirst for knowledge upon discovering that billions of celestial bodies continue to exist in a grand harmony in a vastness of space that has no limits. As such, a man of faith becomes greatly enthralled and inspired to conduct scientific studies to uncover the mysteries of the universe. In one of his articles, Albert Einstein referred to the inspiration scientists derive from religion. I maintain that the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research. Only those who realize the immense efforts and above all the devotion without which pioneer work in theoretical science cannot be achieved are able to grasp the strength of the emotion out of which alone such work, remote as it is from the immediate realities of life, can issue. What a deep conviction of the rationality of the universe, and what a yearning to understand, were it but a feeble reflection of the mind revealed in this world, Kepler and Newton must have had to enable them to spend years of solitary labor in disentangling the principles of celestial mechanics. Johannes Kepler, one of the scientists whom Einstein referred to, related that he engaged in science to delve the Creator's work, while Isaac Newton, another great scientist, stated that the main thrust behind his interest in science was his wish to have a better sense and knowledge of God. These were the remarks of only a few of the most eminent scientists in history. These and hundreds of other scientists came to believe in the existence of God by exploring the universe, and crave to discover more. As we shall see, the desire to learn the manner in which God created the universe has served as the greatest motivating factor for many scientists in history. That is essentially because someone who perceives that the universe and all living things are created also perceives that this creation has a purpose. Purpose, then, leads one to meaning. It is the aspiration to grasp this meaning, to uncover its signs, and discover its details that can greatly expedite scientific studies. If, however, the fact that the universe and living things are created is denied, this meaning escapes too. A scientist believing in the materialist philosophy and in Darwinism will suppose that the universe is purposeless and that everything is the work of blind chance. Therefore, investigation of the universe and living things would be without a pursuit for meaning. Addressing this fact, Einstein stated, "I have found no better expression than religious for confidence in the rational nature of reality insofar as it is accessible to human reason. Whenever this feeling is absent, science degenerates into uninspired empiricism." The sole purpose of a scientist can either be to achieve fame through a groundbreaking discovery, to be remembered in history, or to become wealthy. Such aims may easily divert him from his sincerity and scientific integrity. For instance, in the event that a conclusion he had reached through scientific research was in contradiction with the conventional view of the scientific community, he may be forced to keep it as a secret, so as not to be robbed of his fame, or to be vilified, or degraded. The long-held acceptance of the theory of evolution in the scientific world is an example of this type of lack of sincerity. Basically, many scientists, in the face of scientific fact, are aware that the evolutionary theory is far from being able to explain the origin of life, yet they cannot state it openly, simply out of the fear of encountering a negative reaction. In that line of thought, British physicist H.S. Lipson makes the following confession. We now know a great deal more about living matter than Darwin knew. We know how nerves work, and I regard each nerve as a masterpiece of electrical engineering. And we have thousands of millions of them in our body. Design is the word that springs to mind on this subject. My biologist colleagues do not like it. The word design is cast aside in the scientific literature merely because it is disliked, with many scientists succumbing to such dogmatism. In addressing the issue, Lipson says, "In fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit in with it. This undesirable situation is the result of the deception of ungodly science that held sway over the scientific community beginning in the mid of the 19th century. However, as Einstein stated, science without religion is lame. The delusion has not only directed the scientific community towards mistaken goals, but it has also created scientists who, despite recognizing the error, remain indifferent or silent about it. Scientists who believe in God's oneness and omnipotence have no desire for worldly gain, such as status, rank, reputation, or money. So, their efforts in scientific research are sincere. They know that every mystery of the universe they unravel will increase mankind's understanding of God, helping to reveal God's infinite power and knowledge, confirming God's existence for humanity, demonstrating to it the reality of creation, is a truly important act of worship for a believer. Driven by such sincere concerns, believing scientists conduct important extensive research with a great enthusiasm to discover the laws of the universe, the miraculous systems in nature, and the perfect mechanisms and intelligent behaviors in living things. They achieve great results and make tremendous progress. They never falter in the face of the problems they encounter, nor do they lose heart when they fail to be appreciated by others. They only seek to gain God's approval for the work they do. Scientists who believe in God strive to serve other believers purely for God's good pleasure, and they recognize no limits to their endeavor. They do their best to be of utmost use to people and to serve them in the best way. Furthermore, their sincere efforts make them highly productive, and their studies lead to positive results. Those who assume that science must be distinguished from religion certainly fall into great error. First of all, those who do not believe in God cannot experience the spiritual upliftment of religion. The scientific projects they initiate with zeal soon turn out to be monotonous and uninspiring. Their motivation in such a mindset becomes solely to reap short-lived worldly profit. They pursue the fulfillment of worldly desires such as wealth, rank, reputation, or prestige. They are only committed to conducting research that will directly contribute to such personal benefits. For instance, a scientist motivated by career interests would pursue research only in those fields that will lead to a promotion. He would not be willing to conduct research in a subject he believes to be useful to mankind unless it serves his best interest. Scientists of this sort are rarely of benefit to humanity. failing to serve the greater good unless there is some promised gratification in return. When the opportunity for personal gain fades, so wanes their eagerness to serve humanity. Aware of the blessings he will receive, the enthusiasm and sincere motivation experienced by a person who believes in God opens up new vistas for him, not only in the field of science, but also in many other spheres of life, such as art, culture, and so on. These high spirits never fade, but rather become increasingly intense. Science is the investigation of the material world we live in through observation and experiment. Accordingly, in conducting such investigation, science will lead to various conclusions based on the information collected through observation and experimentation. In addition, however, every discipline of science also has certain norms that are simply taken for granted. In scientific literature, this set of norms is called a paradigm. This initial outlook charts the course of all related scientific investigation. As is known, the first step in scientific investigation is the formation of a hypothesis. To begin with, for their research topic, scientists must form a hypothesis. Then, this hypothesis is tested through scientific experimentation. If observations and experiments verify the hypothesis is called an established principle or law. If the hypothesis is disproved, then new hypotheses are tested and the process continues. The formulation of the hypotheses, which is the first step of the process, is often dependent on the scientist's basic viewpoint. For instance, scientists, if committed to a certain outlook, could base their work on a hypothesis that matter has a tendency to self-organize without the involvement of a conscious agent. Then they would conduct years of research to verify that hypothesis. Yet, since matter has no such capability, all these efforts are bound to fail. Furthermore, if scientists are overly obstinate about their hypothesis, the research may well last for years, and even for generations. The end result, though, would be but a huge waste of time and resources. However, had the point of assumption been the idea that it is impossible for matter to self-organize without conscious planning, the scientific research would have followed a more expeditious and productive course. This issue, that is, the issue of establishing a proper hypothesis, requires an entirely different source than mere scientific data. Correct identification of this source is critical, because as we explained in the above example, an error in the identification of a source may cost the science world years or even centuries. The source sought is God's revelation to mankind. God is the creator of the universe, the world, and of living things, and therefore the most accurate and indisputable knowledge about these subjects derives from Him. In accordance, God has revealed to us important information about these matters in the Quran. The most fundamental of these are as follows. First, God created the universe from nothing. Nothing came into being as a result of random occurrences or of its own accord. It follows that there is not a chaos of chance happenings in nature or the universe, but a perfect order created with an intelligent design. Second, the earth we live in is specially designed to allow for human life. There is a certain purpose in the movements of stars and planets, in geographical landmarks, and in the properties of water or the atmosphere that makes human life possible. Third, all forms of life have come into being by God's creation. All creatures act through the inspiration of God, as quoted in the Quran in the example of the honeybees. These are absolute truths communicated to us by God in the Quran. An approach to science based on these facts will inevitably lead to remarkable progress. Indeed, we find numerous examples of this in history. Muslim scientists, who were then helping to forge the greatest civilization in the world, contributed to major achievements in the 9th and 10th centuries. In the West, the pioneers in all fields of science were great men of science who believed in God and who conducted research for the sake of exploring what He created. Einstein also maintained that scientists must rely on religious sources when developing their objectives. Though religion may be that which determines the goal, it has nevertheless learned from science, in the broadest sense, what means will contribute to the attainment of the goals it has set up. But science can only be created by those who are thoroughly imbued with the aspiration towards truth and understanding. This source of feeling, however, springs from the sphere of religion. I cannot conceive of a genuine scientist without that profound faith. Since the middle of the 19th century, however, the scientific community has divorced itself from this divine source and come under the influence of a materialist philosophy. Materialism is an idea that dates back to ancient Greece. It maintains the absolute existence of matter and denies God. This materialistic outlook gradually made its way into the scientific community. Beginning in the middle of the 19th century, a considerable portion of scientific investigation was initiated to support it. To this purpose, many theories were formulated. The infinite universe model, suggesting that the universe exists since infinite time, is one of these theories. Darwin's evolutionary theory, claiming that life is the work of chance. Or Freud's views, holding that the human mind consists of the brain alone, were also formulated for the same purpose. Today, in retrospect, we see the claims put forth by materialism were but a waste of time for science. For decades, a great number of scientists have expended their best efforts to prove each of these claims. However, the results always prove them wrong. Discoveries confirm the proclamations of the Quran. The universe was created from nothing, and everything was specially designed for a certain purpose. These findings revealed that it is impossible for life to have come into being and evolved by chance. In short, everything is a manifestation of God's superior artistry, and evolution has no room in this magnificent artistry. Until the early 20th century, there was a conventional opinion in the scientific community, which was then under the influence of the materialists. According to this, the universe has infinite dimensions. It existed in infinite time and will exist infinitely. According to this view, called the static universe model, the universe has neither a beginning nor an end. Denying that the universe was created, this view laid the groundwork for the materialist philosophy. Many scientists who espoused materialism or were partial to such a philosophy set the infinite universe model as the basis for their scientific research. Consequently, all research into astronomy and physics depended on the hypothesis that matter existed in infinite time. For some time, many scientists labored and toiled to no avail, as science was soon to shatter that misconception. The Belgian scientist, Georges Lemaître, was the first to recognize the inaccuracy of the infinite universe model and postulated a scientific alternative to it. Based on certain computations by the Russian scientist Alexander Friedman, Lemaître declared that the universe actually had a beginning, and that it was expanding since that initial moment. He also asserted that it must be possible to detect the remnants of radiation from that initial moment. Here, it should be noted that Georges Lemaître was also a priest. His approach to science greatly differed from that of the materialists. In pursuit of this assumption, firstly, American astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered with his huge telescope that the stars were moving away both from us and from each other. This meant that the universe was expanding, and thus was not static as materialists assumed. In fact, earlier on, Albert Einstein had already theoretically calculated that the universe could not be static. However, he put his theory to rest simply because his calculations did not concur with the widely recognized static universe model of his time. Later on, Einstein was to refer to that choice as the greatest mistake of his career. There was another important truth that the expansion of the universe pointed to. If the universe was getting larger as time went on, then following it backward in time meant that everything would converge to a single point. Calculations showed that this single point should have zero volume. Our universe came into being as the result of the explosion of this point, an explosion which has come to be called the Big Bang. In fact, the reference to this exploding point having zero volume is but a theoretical expression. The expression of zero volume simply suggests nothingness. The whole universe was created from nothing. The Big Bang theory clearly demonstrated that the universe was created from nothing. Nevertheless, further scientific evidence was required in order for the theory to be widely accepted. In 1948, George Gamow proposed that there ought to be a definite amount of radiation left over from that explosion, and that this radiation must be uniform throughout the universe. Scientific confirmation of Gamow's postulate was forthcoming. In 1965, two researchers by the name of Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson discovered the remnants of that radiation. Called cosmic background radiation, it was not localized but distributed equally everywhere in the universe. It was soon realized that this radiation was the echo of the Big Bang, still reverberating since the first moments of that great explosion. Penzias and Wilson were awarded a Nobel Prize for their discovery. In 1989, NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, launched the COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer, satellite into space for the purpose of research into cosmic background radiation. Within minutes, the satellite's sensitive scanners confirmed the measurements of Penzias and Wilson. Discovery of the evidence confirming the creation of the universe from nothing in the Big Bang staggered materialist scientists. They witnessed the collapse of their extensive research and unsubstantiated theories, one after the other. The renowned atheist philosopher Anthony Flew had these comments to offer about the situation. Notoriously, confession is good for the soul. I will therefore begin by confessing that the Stratonician atheist has to be embarrassed by the model of Big Bang. For it seems that the cosmologists are providing a scientific proof of what St. Thomas contended could not be proved philosophically, namely, that the universe has a beginning. So long as the universe can be comfortably thought of as being not only without end, but also without beginning, it remains easy to urge that its brute existence and whatever else are found to be its most fundamental features should be accepted as the explanatory ultimates. Although I believe that it remains still correct, it certainly is neither easy nor comfortable to maintain this position in the face of the Big Bang story. As the above example makes clear, if someone is blindly devoted to materialism, he is reluctant to admit any evidence to the contrary. Even if he must confess to the fact, he does not compromise his commitment to materialism. On the other hand, many scientists today accept that God, the all-powerful, created the universe. One such example is the American scientist William Lang Craig, who is known for his research in the Big Bang. In an article, he wrote, "Indeed, given the truth of the maxim, ex nihilo nihil fit, out of nothing comes nothing, the Big Bang requires a supernatural cause. Since the initial cosmological singularity represents the terminus of all space-time trajectories, there cannot be any physical cause of the Big Bang. Rather, the cause must transcend physical space and time. It must be independent of the universe, and unimaginably powerful. Moreover, this cause must be a personal being, endowed with free will. The cause of the origin of the universe must therefore be a personal creator, who a finite time ago brought the universe into existence by his free agency." Materialists not only propose that the universe existed since infinite time, but also claim that there is no design or purpose in the universe. They argue that the entire equilibrium, harmony, and order in the universe was the work of chance. This claim, which dominated the world of science beginning in the second half of the 19th century, dictated the subsequent course of scientific investigation. For instance, certain scientists put forth an assumption called the chaos theory to show that there is no design in the universe. According to this theory, order may spontaneously form from chaos. A number of scientific studies were conducted to support the claim. Every new discovery, however, further denied the chaos and chance theories, revealing that there is an enormous design in the universe. Research conducted since the 1960s consistently demonstrated that all the physical equilibria in the universe are intricately designed to render life possible. With these discoveries, the claims of coincidence formerly imposed on the scientific community by the materialist philosophy were exposed to be an unscientific fallacy. Noted molecular biologist Michael Denton makes the following comment. "The picture that has emerged in 20th century astronomy presents a dramatic challenge to the presumptions which have been prevalent within scientific circles during most of the past four centuries, that life is a peripheral and purely contingent phenomenon in the cosmic scheme. The evidence provided by modern cosmology and physics is exactly the kind of evidence that the natural theologians were looking for in the 17th century but failed to find in the science of their day." Here, the real point to be considered is the extraordinary amount of time that has gone into studies to prove the materialist delusion that claimed there is no purpose and design in the universe. All these theories, formulae, and studies eventually proved to be worthless attempts expended in vain. Just as the racist ideology brought disaster for humanity by leading to World War II, so did the materialist ideology dragged the world of science into darkness needlessly. If, however, the scientific community had based its efforts not on the misconception of materialism, but on the reality that the universe was created by God, scientific research would have taken a more proper course. We must remember that the time lost in the 20th century in the world of science is the improper orientation for science. The important thing is to take lessons from the past and try not to make the same mistakes again. This is the responsibility of every individual. So, you too fulfill your share of the responsibility and tell people the dark face of the theory of evolution and its forgeries. Throughout history, there has been various times when science was based on wrong foundations and scientists engaged in misguided research. The most instructive example of an improper orientation for science was the adoption of Darwin's evolutionary theory. Having been introduced to the agenda of scientific study 140 years ago, this theory is actually the greatest fallacy perpetrated in the history of science. The theory of evolution contends that life came about by the configuration of lifeless matter through chance. The same theory further claims that organisms which have been formed by chance evolved into other creatures, again by chance. At center stage for the last 1.5 centuries has been the concerted effort to find scientific justification for this scenario, whose results, though ironically, proved only the contrary. Scientific evidence has demonstrated that evolution never took place. According to scientific findings, the possibility of the gradual transformation from one species to another is out of the question, and that all living species were created distinctly and in their present forms. Nevertheless, despite all firm evidence, evolutionists perform countless studies and experiments, write volumes of books to prove evolution. They establish institutions, hold conferences, and air television programs. The exploitation of thousands of scientists and measureless amounts of money and resources for an unprovable assertion has certainly been a serious detriment for humanity. Had these resources been properly directed, such a loss would not have been incurred, but great strides rather would have been achieved and definitive results attained in more pertinent areas of scientific study. On the other hand, a number of scientists or thinkers have realized what a grave misconception the theory of evolution has been. British philosopher Malcolm Muggeridge, for instance, makes the following comment. I myself am convinced that the theory of evolution, especially the extent to which it's been applied, will be one of the great jokes in the history books in the future. Posterity will marvel that so very flimsy and dubious an hypothesis could be accepted with the incredible credulity that it has. Even a number of evolutionary scientists have recognized that the theory they advocate does not concur with fact and feel uneasy about it. Perpetuation of today's theory of evolution as dogma will not encourage progress towards more satisfactory explanations of observed phenomena, says evolutionist scientist Paul R. Ehrlich in an interview with Science. With this statement, Ehrlich, though indirectly, admits the harm blind devotion to the evolutionary theory inflicts on science. Since antiquity, the answers of certain questions have always been a matter of curiosity. What is the origin of life? What distinguishes a bird or a giraffe from stone, water, earth, that is, inanimate matter? The predominant views are two. The first idea is that there is a very fine line between animate and inanimate matter, which can easily be pierced, and that life can spontaneously arise from animate matter. This view is called abiogenesis in scientific literature. The second idea maintains that there is an unsurpassable border between living and non-living matter. According to this view, it is impossible for living organisms to develop from non-living materials, and a life form can arise only if it comes from another life form. This view, summed up as life comes only from life, is called biogenesis. Interestingly, the idea of abiogenesis is connected to the materialist philosophy, whereas the idea of biogenesis stems from religious sources. The materialist philosophy has always argued that non-living materials can give rise to living organisms. On the contrary, divine sources state that the only power to give life to inanimate matter can be God's creative power. Surah Al-An'am, verse 95 in the Quran reads, It is God who causes the seed grain and the date stone to split and sprout. He causes the living to issue from the dead, and He is the one to cause the dead to issue from the living. That is God. Then how are you deluded away from the truth? In the Middle Ages, when people had a very limited knowledge of nature, the view of abiogenesis prevailed because of certain erroneous observations. Those who saw that maggots developed on uncovered meat thought that it happened spontaneously. This belief, also called spontaneous generation, was widely accepted until the 17th century. Experiments conducted by two important scientists, however, laid the idea of spontaneous generation in its grave. The first of them was Francesco Redi. Redi showed that the maggots that appeared on meat came from flies laying their eggs on it. Upon this discovery, the defenders of the abiogenesis idea retreated and claimed that not big organisms like maggots or frogs, but invisible microbes were produced from non-living matter. The debate lingered over the next two centuries. The French biologist Louis Pasteur finally demonstrated, through a series of experiments, that microbes could not develop from non-living materials either. Redi and Pasteur had one thing in common. Both scientists believed in the existence of God, and that life was created by Him. Their belief played a critical role in the recognition of the absurdity of the idea of abiogenesis. Evolutionist scientists, however, went on resisting this evident reality. Their blind devotion to the materialist philosophy drew them into a futile struggle that would last a century. After a while, two materialist scientists, Alexander Oparin and J.P. Haldane, introduced the notion of chemical evolution. According to Oparin and Haldane, abiogenesis did not take place in a short time, but happened over a long period. In conflict with certain scientific laws, foremost among them the second law of thermodynamics, this claim led the science world into a stalemate, contributing to a detrimental amount of lost time. Over the course of the century, a number of scientists conducted experiments in favor of the chemical evolution hypothesis, or exerted great pains to support the claim with new theories. Huge laboratories, major institutions, and university divisions were set into action. All these efforts, however, ended in failure. Well-known evolutionist Professor Klaus Dos, the director of the Institute of Biochemistry at Johannes Gutenberg University, confessed that all attempts to produce evidence for the claim that non-living materials produce living matter were inconclusive. More than 30 years of experimentation on the origin of life in the fields of chemical and molecular evolution have led to a better perception of the immensity of the problem of the origin of life on Earth rather than to its solution. At present, all discussions on principal theories and experiments in the field either end in stalemate or in a confession of ignorance. If the scientific world had not become obsessed with the idea of abiogenesis, all such efforts conducted in the name of chemical evolution could have been channeled to more productive areas. Had the scientific community started out by recognizing that life is created by God, all this wasted time, money, and human resources could have been avoided. Would such have been the case, science could concentrate on new discoveries and research useful to mankind, rather than seeking to prove ancient Greek myths. Today, the scientific community has demonstrated that non-living materials cannot self-organize through random events and form even a single cell. It has also become obvious that the millions of life forms we see around us could not have formed, as evolutionists claim, from cells that came together accidentally. A scientist performing extensive studies into these subjects is by no means a product of the common decision taken by unconscious atoms. It is impossible for unconscious atoms to develop a fully conscious human being. In this regard, hundreds of years ago, it was related in the Quran that life was created by God from nothing, that God alone gives life, and no other being but He has the power to give life. If science had ascertained the implications of the facts transmitted by God to mankind, it would not have toyed away in inconclusive research for such a long period of time. There are millions of living species on the Earth, and these species differ from one another in a variety of ways. They greatly differ from each other in their physical characteristics, habitats, hunting techniques, defense tactics, feeding habits, reproduction, and so on. So how did these creatures come into being? Anyone who reflects upon this question, employing the faculty of his reason, would see that all living things are designed. That is, created. Every design proves the existence of an intelligent designer that has produced it. Living things, just as all other examples of design in nature, prove the existence of God. This truth has been revealed to us through religion. In the Quran, we are informed how living things came into being. All living species were created distinctively by God. God, with His unique creative power and infinite knowledge, equipped creatures with diverse features, and thus communicated His infinite power, wisdom, and knowledge to humanity. 29th verse of Surah Shura that refer to the creation of living things reads, "And among His signs is the creation of the heavens and the earth, and the living creatures that He has scattered through them. And He has power to gather them together when He wills." Having recognized the reality of creation, scientists established various disciplines such as biology, anatomy, and paleontology. Noted scientists like Carl Linnaeus, who categorized the living world under definite classes, and who is known as the founder of taxonomy, was aware of this reality. George Cuvier, the founder of fossil science and comparative anatomy, also believed in creation. Gregor Mendel, the founder of genetics, who discovered the laws of inheritance, was a scientist who believed in God. Louis Agassiz, who is considered the greatest American biologist of the 19th century, also practiced science with an awareness that all living species were created by God. Then, with the introduction of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, the world of science became immersed in an effort to prove that species evolved from one another. This endeavor caused scientists to engage themselves in a number of fruitless investigations. In fossil excavations conducted all around the world, scientists look for intermediate form fossils that had existed at no time in history. Moreover, imaginary scenarios were fabricated to explain how certain species could have evolved into each other. Science journals published these scenarios, and eventually, these were taught to students in schools. It will be helpful to quote some of these scenarios to demonstrate how evolutionists subject science to their wild fantasies. For instance, the following story was printed in an evolutionist article regarding the transition of reptiles into mammals. Some of the reptiles in the colder regions began to develop a method of keeping their bodies warm. Their heat output increased when it was cold, and their heat loss was cut down when scales became smaller and more pointed, and evolved into fur. Sweating was also an adaptation to regulate the body temperature, a device to cool the body when necessary by evaporation of water. But incidentally, the young of these reptiles began to lick the sweat of the mother for nourishment. Certain sweat glands began to secrete a richer and richer secretion, which eventually became milk. Thus, the young of these early mammals had a better start in life. In order to substantiate this evolutionary hypothesis, evolutionists worked very hard. They wasted their time trying to scientifically prove impossible occurrences such as the transition of sweat into milk and scales into fur. Certainly, such efforts have been in vain. Mainly, mother's milk is a substance specially regulated according to the needs of a baby and is moderated depending on each phase within a plan. Everything a baby needs is found in the mother's milk just when it needs to be. For instance, the day the baby needs potassium is the same as the day the mother's milk is rich in potassium. This specialization is true for all the other materials the baby needs throughout its development. It is obviously impossible for such a nutriment to have formed by unconscious coincidences. By the same token, the story of the evolution of reptile scales into mammal furs is clearly at odds with scientific facts. Scales and fur have completely different structures. Firstly, fur is follicular, that is, it grows out of a sac. Scales, on the other hand, are plate-like structures within the skin. In addition, scales develop, grow, and are shed in a completely different way from that of fur. Secondly, there is no scientific evidence suggesting that fur evolved from scales. Evolutionists have no fossil evidence to prove this claim, just as they can put forth no logical mechanism to account for this transformation. This is not the only unscientific tale put forth as to the transformation of reptiles into mammals. Every evolutionist has a story of his own. Similarly, quite a few imaginary scenarios have been produced as to how dinosaurs evolved into birds. One of these scenarios holds that some dinosaurs started to fly as they chased flies. Another argues that dinosaurs developed wings as they jumped from one tree to the next. Finally, science was wont to prove these scenarios produced by the imagination of the evolutionists. Thus far, a great number of scientists have conducted research into how dinosaurs could have started to fly as they ran or jumped from tree branches. Many others spent years to show how scales turned into bird feathers. Well-known evolutionist and ornithologist Alan Feduccia is one of these scientists who spent his life working on the subject. Having spent 25 years searching for a link between dinosaurs and birds, Feduccia offered the following confession. "Well, I've studied bird skulls for 25 years, and I don't see any similarities whatsoever. I just don't see it. The theropod origins of birds, in my opinion, will be the greatest embarrassment to paleontology of the 20th century." Evolutionist scenarios are not limited to these. Just as evolutionist paleontologist Dr. Colin Patterson admitted, there have been an awful lot of stories, some more imaginative than others, about what the nature of that history of life really is. The most fantastic claim of evolutionists is about the imaginary evolution of whales. Evolutionists put forth that sea mammals, like whales and dolphins, evolved from bears that liked swimming. What's more, in order to provide a basis for this scenario, they have produced theories about half-bear, half-whale creatures, and even fabricated stories of walking whales. Evolutionists are free to dream and believe in any scenario they wish. The real problem is that they waste the science world's resources and time in the hope of proving these scenarios. As another renowned evolutionist scientist, Pierre-Paul Grasset, said regarding these evolutionary scenarios, "There is no law against daydreaming, but science must not indulge in it." Science will continue to hopelessly pursue such myths as long as scientists base their studies on incorrect hypotheses such as Darwinism. The acknowledgement of the reality of creation, on the other hand, will put an end to all these vain endeavors which inhibit the progress of science. As we have mentioned earlier, all living things were created individually by God. Their physical characteristics, feeding habits, hunting techniques, defense tactics, the way they foster their young, etc., all reflect perfect harmonies. There is no point in investigating how these harmonies could have come about by chance. This perfection could not have come into being haphazardly. It could only have come about through the power and control of our Lord, the Supreme Creator. Therefore, it would be much more worthwhile to investigate verifiable realities and their details rather than producing completely imaginary scenarios. Most importantly, research with such an intent would help us to better know God, the Almighty, who created human beings and the entire universe from nothing. The evolutionary theory caused science considerable loss of time. One of the assertions of the evolutionary theory which has wasted the science's time was the delusive pursuit for beneficial mutations. Neo-Darwinism, which has emerged in recent times, has put forth two concepts as evolutionary mechanisms, one of which is mutation. Therefore, scientists were bent on proving that mutations could create beneficial effects on human things as far as the theory of evolution is concerned. However, mutations are always harmful and have never been observed to have an evolutionary effect. Evolutionists tenaciously devised artificial mutation models. They worked for decades to observe a beneficial mutation. For instance, fruit flies were mutated numerous times with the hope that they would give rise to a mutation improving the genetic code. The result was an utter fiasco. Evolutionist Michael Pittman made the following remark about these extensive, albeit inconclusive, mutation experiments. "Numerous geneticists have subjected generations of fruit flies to extreme conditions of heat, cold, light, dark, and treatment by chemicals and radiation. All sorts of mutations, practically all trivial or positively deleterious, have been produced. Man-made evolution? Not really. Few of the geneticists' monsters could have survived outside the bottles they were bred in. In practice, mutants die, are sterile, or tend to revert to the wild type." Renowned evolutionist Gordon Taylor also stated that 50 years were lost to mutation experiments. In all the thousands of fly breeding experiments carried out all over the world for more than 50 years, a distinct new species has never been seen to emerge, or even a new enzyme. Evolutionary arguments in other scientific areas have been no different. Nevertheless, evolutionists advocate Darwinism despite all scientific evidence and then present their persistence as scientific perseverance. What they practice, however, is not scientific perseverance, but resistance to science. The evolutionary theory caused a great time loss in every field of science. Paleontology, that is the study of fossils, is one of them. This science branch was also pushed into a blind alley to prove the theory of evolution. There is no doubt that paleontological studies are essential to enlightening us about the history of life on the Earth. The erroneous preconceptions of the evolutionary theory, however, have had a negative effect on fossil research and misled scientists. In particular, paleontologists investigating the origin of man are caught in a quandary. All research carried out to discover a half-ape, half-human creature has been a complete waste of time. It must be mentioned that fossil excavations are carried out under very different conditions and require large budgets. Excavations are conducted in regions such as African deserts. Crowded teams of researchers maintain camps for months in these places. They work under the scorching sun and with budgets over billions of dollars. Yet, these excavations conducted for the last 1.5 centuries have not presented any concrete results. Well-known fossil researcher Richard Leakey and renowned science writer Roger Lewin made the following confession regarding the inconclusiveness of these studies. If someone went to the trouble of collecting into one room all the fossil remains so far discovered of our ancestors and their biological relatives who lived, say, between 5 and 1 million years ago, he would need only a couple of large trestle tables on which to spread them out. And if that were not bad enough, a not unusually commodious shoebox would be more than sufficient to accommodate the hominid fossil finds of between 15 and 6 million years ago. All these were a waste of time, knowledge, labor, money, and resources, mistakenly undertaken under the guise of science. All around the world, numberless resources have been consecrated to the service of a false allegation. Thousands of universities, scientific institutions, and organizations worked on this subject. Millions of scientists, instructors, and students wasted their time for it. Laboratories, technicians, and technical equipment were assigned to this issue only. The end result is literally nothing. And moreover, new discoveries continue to expose the fallacy of the evolutionary hypothesis. In fact, conducting extensive research and study of fallacious and inconclusive hypotheses is also emotionally draining for evolutionist scientists. When they come to understand that the research for which they have devoted their lives is futile and useless, they feel great despair. Conducting scientific research requires great discipline and self-sacrifice. Carrying out long, drawn-out experiments and observations in the laboratory for a premise which they know will come to nothing, and only to discover that the direct opposite of the hypothesis they want to prove is correct, is certainly quite upsetting for some scientists. Some evolutionists in the scientific community have admitted to suffering such desperation. For instance, evolutionist paleontologist Dr. Colin Patterson, the senior paleontologist of the British Museum of Natural History, made the following famous comments. Question is, can you tell me anything you know about evolution, any one thing that is true? I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer I got was silence. Then I woke up and realized that all my life I had been duped into taking evolutionism as revealed truth in some way. Somewhere else in the same speech, Patterson also noted, one of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view was last year I had a sudden realization that I had been working on this stuff for 20 years and there was not one thing I knew about it. That's quite a shock to learn that one can be so misled so long. Evolutionist Dr. N. Herbert Nielsen, director of the Botanical Institute at Lund University, Sweden, confessed to having wasted over 40 years for nothing, saying, "My attempt to demonstrate evolution by an experiment carried out for more than 40 years has completely failed." These individual examples show what science has suffered by pursuing a false theory. For decades, the knowledge, time, energy, work, laboratory, assistance, and financial resources of thousands of scientists have been wasted on a bogus attempt to support the myth of evolution. More interestingly, even Charles Darwin, the founder of the theory, often fretted about spending his time for nothing, and that he will be disappointed at the end. Darwin repeatedly talked about his worries over this point in his letters to his friends or in his articles. In one of these, he confessed that there is no evidence in nature to support his theory. "All nature is perverse and will not do as I wish it." Darwin's lack of self-confidence is also manifest in his following words. "Nevertheless, I doubt whether the work of writing The Origin of Species was worth the consumption of so much time." Obviously, a fallacious theory, if advocated purely for ideological reasons, also causes distress and desperation in its proponents. Such are the inevitable consequences of setting science on an erroneous course. One of the issues that inflicted great harm on science is evolutionist frauds. Attempts to make observations, experiments, and research concur with evolution, the covering up of the truths of their distorted presentation, has certainly been a serious impediment to scientific progress. In this part, we will examine what losses evolutionist frauds have caused for science. As evolutionists were unable to discover evidence in support of their theory, now and then they deceived humanity by distorting their scientific findings and perpetrating hoaxes. The most notorious of these hoaxes was the Pitdown Man scandal. Unable to discover fossils of half-ape, half-human creatures, which they alleged to have existed, evolutionists finally decided to produce one themselves. First, they mounted an orangutan's jaw onto a human skull. Then they gave it a dated appearance by treating it with certain chemicals. For several years they exhibited this skull in the most famous museum of the world as a human ancestor. F. Clark Howell, an evolutionist himself, describes the detriment this fraud has caused for science as such. Pitdown was discovered in 1953 to have been nothing more than an ape's jaw placed with a human skull. It was a hoax placed on purpose. They recognized neither the jaw to be an ape's or the skull to be a human's. Instead, they declared each part as an in-between of ape and human. They dated it to be 500,000 years old, gave it a name, and wrote some 500 books on it. The discovery fooled paleontologists for 45 years. The words of this scientist are truly remarkable. "A false piece of so-called evidence fooled the scientific community for 40 years. The fact that 500 books were written about a fraudulent skull is a glaring indication of effort expended for naught." The perpetrator of another evolutionary fraud is Ernst Haeckel. Haeckel not only confessed to his forgery, but also refer to the distortions committed by his colleagues in order to perpetrate their various ideologies. "After this compromising confession of forgery, I should be obliged to consider myself condemned and annihilated if I had not the consolation of seeing side by side with me in the prisoner's dock hundreds of fellow culprits, among them many of the most trusted observers and most esteemed biologists. The great majority of all the diagrams in the best biological textbooks, treatises, and journals would incur in the same degree the charge of forgery, for all of them are inexact, and are more or less doctored, schematized, and constructed. These efforts of evolutionists are due to their adherence to the materialist movement that was prevalent at their time. Since the 18th century, science has been under the influence of materialists. Therefore, almost all research was intended to provide scientific evidence for the materialist philosophy. Scientific evidence discounting the materialist philosophy was either covered up or presented in a distorted manner. What is more interesting is that every study and experiment made by evolutionists to prove evolution provided further evidence in support of creation. Science is relatively simple and trouble-free for those who believe in God's existence. Investigating a phenomenon known to exist and looking for evidence for it would cause no trouble for scientists. On the contrary, to seek out non-existent evidence is tedious and annoying, as they themselves attest. One of the most blatant examples of this is the paleontological findings of the Cambrian period. This is the name given to the period which is estimated to date back 550 million years. The first signs of life have been observed at this period. All of the life forms that existed in this period were fully developed creatures possessing highly complex systems. For instance, an extinct creature called the tribolite possesses a complicated compound eye structure. Composed of 100 lenses, his eye structure is the same as that of some modern insects such as the dragonfly. What is troublesome for the evolutionists is that these creatures, exhibiting such complex structures, appear in this stratum all of a sudden and without any ancestors. These scientific facts clearly point to creation. Renowned evolutionist, scientist, British zoologist Richard Dawkins explains the situation as follows. For example, the Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage around 600 million years, are the oldest ones in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution, the very first time they appear. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. The state of inconclusiveness in the field of paleontology is one of the gravest impasses to encumber the evolutionary theory. This is because evolutionist scientists have expended their best efforts for decades to find transitional forms that will provide evidence of evolution. Yet they have never achieved any concrete results, because such creatures have never existed on the Earth. Evolutionist paleontologist Mark Czarnecki makes the following comment about the failure of evolutionists to find the fossils of transitional forms which they have been looking for. A major problem in proving the theory has been the fossil record, the imprints of vanished species preserved in the Earth's geological formations. This record has never revealed traces of Darwin's hypothetical intermediate variants. Instead, species appear and disappear abruptly, and this anomaly has fueled the creationist argument that each species was created by God. It is evident that every endeavor to seek scientific justification for evolution has proved unsuccessful and failed to lead to any definite conclusions. On the contrary, each study conducted by evolutionist scientists points to an irrepressible truth: the reality that all living things are created flawlessly by God, the Lord of the heavens and the earth. Our immediate surroundings and the universe we live in teem with numerous signs of creation. Implicit in the fascinating system of a mosquito, the glorious artistry of the wings of a peacock, a complex and perfectly functioning organ like the eye, and millions of other forms of life, are signs of the existence of God and His supreme knowledge and wisdom for people who believe. A scientist who maintains that creation is a fact views nature from this perspective and derives great pleasure in every observation he makes and every experiment he conducts. Therefore, he gains inspiration for further studies. On the other hand, believing in a myth such as evolution and adhering to it despite the findings of science results in an emotional state of despair. The harmony in the universe and the design of living things becomes rather a great source of trouble to them. The following words of Darwin offer us a glimpse into the sentiments of most evolutionists. I remember well the time when the thought of the eye made me cold all over, but I have got over this stage of complaint, and now trifling particulars of structure often make me very uncomfortable. The sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick. The feathers of a peacock, as well as countless other signs of creation in nature, continue to discomfort evolutionists. Turning a blind eye to such apparent miracles, they develop an ambivalence to such truths, accompanied by a mental state of denial. A good case to this point is the prominent evolutionist Richard Dawkins, who calls upon Christians not to assume they have witnessed a miracle, even if they see the statue of the Virgin Mary waving to them. According to Dawkins, perhaps all the atoms of the statue's arm just happen to move in the same direction at once, a low probability event to be sure, but possible. In order for science to progress, these holdovers of the 19th century must be pushed aside, and free-thinking scientists bold enough to admit the facts they apprehend take their place. Materialists, in an attempt to conceal their defeat by science, often take recourse through various propaganda methods. Foremost of them is the cliché of the conflict between science and religion, commonly employed by materialist publications. These sources cover stories intended to incite the common reader, suggesting that throughout history religion has always been against science, and that science can progress only if religion is ruled out. A quick look at the history of science, however, will be sufficient to point out the falsehood of this claim. When we look at the history of Islam, we see that science was introduced into the Middle East along with the Quran. Pre-Islamic Arabs believed in all sorts of superstitions and hearsay, and conducted no investigation of the universe or nature. With Islam, this community became civilized and beginning to hold knowledge in high regard. By observing the commands of the Quran, people began to examine the world around them. Not only Arabs, but many other nations such as the Iranians, Turks, and North Africans became enlightened after embracing Islam. The use of reason and observation commanded in the Quran gave rise to a great civilization in the 9th and 10th centuries. Many Muslim scientists living during that period made significant discoveries in a number of disciplines, such as astronomy, mathematics, geometry, and medicine. Producing many Muslim scientists of her own, Andalusia was a crucible of revolutionary discoveries and scientific progress, particularly in the field of medicine. Muslim physicians did not specialize in a single subject, but conducted studies in a wide range of fields. One of the most noted Andalusian physicians was Ibn Juljul, who conducted extensive studies and produced works on medical herbs. Another distinguished physician of the time was Abu Ja'far ibn al-Jazar from Tunisia, who mastered the science of drug therapy for the treatment of specific symptoms and diseases and authored more than 30 books. Abd al-Latif al-Baghdadi is known for his studies in anatomy. Muslim anatomists determined the number of bones in the human skull correctly. They also discovered the existence of 3 ossicles in the ear. One of the leading Muslim scientists working in anatomy was Ibn Sina, known as Avicenna in the West. Ibn Sina was not only widely known in the East, but also in the West. His most popular work, Al-Qanun, known as the Canon in the West, was written in Arabic and after its translation into Latin in the 12th century, became the textbook of the schools of Europe until the 17th century. A significant portion of the medical knowledge included in the canon is still accepted today. Zakaria Kwazini countered many mistaken beliefs about the heart and the brain that had been professed since Aristotle. The facts he provided about the heart and the brain are very close to our knowledge of today. The works in anatomy of Zakaria Kwazwini and Ibn al-Nafis laid the foundation of modern medicine. These scientists demonstrated as early as the 13th and 14th centuries the connections between the heart and the lungs. They explained that the arteries carry oxygenated blood and the veins carry deoxygenated blood, that the blood is oxygenated in the lungs. They demonstrated that the oxygenated blood that returns to the heart is carried to the brain and other organs of the body via the aorta. The first volume of Ali bin Isa's 3-volume work is entirely devoted to the anatomy of the eye and includes very detailed information. The work was translated into Latin and German. There were also many Muslim scientists who made great contributions to various disciplines other than medicine and anatomy. For instance, Al-Biruni knew that the earth rotates around its own axis some 600 years prior to Galileo, and determined the earth's circumference some 700 years prior to Newton. Ali Kushchu, a 15th century scientist, was the first to make a map of the moon, and a region of the moon has been named after him. Thabit ibn Qura, or Thebit as known in the West, who lived in the 9th century, invented differential calculus centuries before Newton. Battani, a 10th century scientist, is the first developer of trigonometry. Abul Wafa Muhammad al-Bujani introduced the tangent, cotangent, secant, cosecant to trigonometry for the first time. Al-Khwarizmi wrote the first book on algebra in the 9th century. Al-Maribi invented the equation known today as the Pascal triangle, some 600 years prior to Pascal. Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazen in the West, who lived in the 11th century, was the founder of optics. Roger Bacon and Kepler made use of his works, and Galileo invented the telescope by referring to them. Al-Kindi, or Al-Kindus, as he is known in the West, introduced relative physics and the theory of relativity some 1,100 years prior to Einstein. Shams al-Din, who lived some 400 years prior to Pasteur, was the first to discover the existence of germs. Ali ibn al-Abbas lived in the 10th century and was the first to perform cancer surgery. In the same century, Ibn al-Jazar introduced the reasons and treatment methods of leprosy. These Muslim scientists, only some of whom are mentioned here, have made important discoveries that laid the foundation of modern science. In the early 19th century, a series of publications was released in Britain called the Bridgewater Treatises. A number of scientists conducted research on a variety of disciplines and defined the object of their study to be the signs of the harmony and order God created in the universe and nature. It was William Paley's natural theology that pioneered the Bridgewater Treatises. In this book, Paley gave examples of design in living things, displaying comprehensive knowledge of anatomy. Taking Paley's work as a model, a call was made to the nominated members of the Royal Society of London. It was further directed that those so selected should be appointed to write, print, and publish 1,000 copies of a work on the power, wisdom, and goodness of God as manifested in the creation, illustrated such work by all reasonable arguments as, for instance, the variety and formation of God's creatures in the animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdoms, the effect of digestion and thereby of conversion, the construction of the hand of man, and an infinite variety of other arguments, as also by discoveries ancient and modern in arts, sciences, and the whole extent of modern literature. This call to explore the signs of God's existence was answered by many scientists who produced highly valuable studies. The main thrust behind numerous scientific studies conducted both before and after these works was to know the universe God created, and thus perceive His almightiness. The scientific community's deviation from this initial course was brought about by the predominance of the materialist philosophy. In 19th century Western culture, that resulted due to certain social and political conditions. This process finds its fullest expression in Darwin's theory of evolution, culminating in direct contradiction to the former view in the presentation of science and religion as two bitterly conflicting sources of knowledge. Referring to this development, British researchers Michael Bagent, Richard Ley, and Henry Lincoln make this comment. For Isaac Newton, a century and a half before Darwin, science was not separate from religion, but, on the contrary, an aspect of religion, and ultimately subservient to it. But the science of Darwin's time became precisely that, divorcing itself from the context in which it had previously existed and establishing itself as a rival absolute, an alternative repository of meaning. As a result, religion and science were no longer working in concert, but rather stood opposed to each other, and humanity was increasingly forced to choose between them. Today, however, this contrived conflict between religion and science is found to be contrary to the very findings of science. Religion declares that the universe was created from nothingness, and science has found proofs of that. Religion teaches us that living things are created by God, and science has provided us with evidence of this in the design discovered in living things. This conclusion, attained by science, has helped a growing number of scientists to come to a strong belief in God. Confronted by the conclusion established by science, all that the materialist can do is set certain pressure tactics into action. In this way, they seek to intimidate the rest of the scientific community. In the West, a scientist has to conform to certain expectations in order to be promoted, to receive his or her MD or PhD, or to have his articles published in scientific journals. The number one condition required is to accept the theory of evolution unconditionally. For this reason, some scientists are forced to uphold Darwin's myths, which they may actually reject, disregarding the signs of creation. In an article published in the Scientific American magazine in the September 1999 issue titled Scientists and Religion in America, University of Washington sociologist Rodney Stark points out the pressures imposed on scientists. There's been 200 years of marketing that if you want to be a scientific person, you've got to keep your mind free of the fetters of religion. In research universities, the religious people keep their mouth shut, and their irreligious people discriminate. There is a reward system to being irreligious in the upper echelons. Ceaseless efforts of materialists to conceal the fact of creation will yield no results. Materialism and Darwinism, which are false systems, are bound to be defeated by truth. As God says in Surah Isra, verse 81, say, truth has come and falsehood has vanished. Falsehood is always bound to vanish. Materialists wage a systematic struggle against science. One of the methods they use with this purpose is unsubstantiated propaganda. Central to this propaganda are mottos such as religion conflicts with science, or science has got to be materialists. Now, let us see why these claims are illogical and unsustainable. Evolutionists often take recourse to propaganda methods to divorce science from religion. Anti-religionist circles that commonly use the errant practices and reactions of the medieval church as a weapon against religion is an example of this. It is said that the church retarded Europe and caused its severe misery. Implicit in these efforts is the attempt to associate the medieval church with religion and to deliver the message that if religion prevails, we will be buried in the darkness of the Middle Ages. True religion, however, is not reflected in the practices and reactions of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, abandoning the true revelation brought by the Prophet Jesus, adopted certain irreligious practices. Science indubitably suffered great harm at the hands of the Church, which was ruled by a clergy serving the special interests of certain few, thus completely divorcing itself from its divine source. This historical development, however, cannot be attributed to the religion of Islam. Islam is based not on the superstitions of its clergy, but on the Quran only, which is the word of God. A number of materialists who want to portray religion and science as inimical not only incite examples from the practices of the Catholic Church, but also quote specific passages from the Torah or the Bible to demonstrate how they contradict scientific discoveries. Yet there is one truth they either disregard or pretend ignorance of. The Bible and the Torah are altered texts. Both include many superstitions produced by man. Therefore, it would be very wrong to regard these books as basic reference sources of religion. The Quran, on the other hand, is the revelation of God. It has not been altered in the least. Not even a single letter of it has been changed. For this reason, all the facts proclaimed by the Quran parallel scientific findings. Moreover, numerous scientific facts that could only be discovered in our day were announced in the Quran 1,400 years ago. This is an important miracle of the Quran and is one of the definitive proofs that it is the Word of God. Aware of this, materialists are unable to quote any verses from the Quran for their purposes. This is the main reason why they cite only the Bible or the Torah to express their anti-religionist views. Another propaganda tool used by scientists is the cliché that scientific studies matter alone. Therefore, it ought to be materialists. Actually, this is nothing but a play on words. It is true that science studies matter alone, but this does not imply that it needs to be materialistic, for studying matter and being materialist are very different things. When we study matter, we conclude that this matter contains a knowledge and design too great to come about of its own. We can appreciate that this knowledge and design was consciously created by an intelligent agent. Let us consider, for instance, a cave, which we do not know whether anyone has visited it before us or not. If we see, when we enter it, impressive, masterful pictures on the walls of the cave, we then conclude there must have been an intelligent agent here before us, who obviously produced these many works. We may never see this intelligent agent, but we know of his existence from his artifacts. It is in this manner that science studies nature and discovers that there is an order in nature which can by no means be explained by material factors. Science reveals a design that could only have been brought into being through supramaterial wisdom. In other words, the material world teems with evident signs of God's creative power and authority. One who subscribes to a certain view is free to test whether that view can be verified by scientific facts and to perform scientific research for that purpose. A person, for instance, can proclaim that the world is flat and conduct research to support his assertion. The important matter is how this person assesses the scientific data he accumulates. A scientist evaluating scientific results objectively will be unable to find any evidence proving that the Earth is flat. On the contrary, he will encounter much evidence that the Earth is elliptical. In this case, what this person must do is to admit the truth without prejudice and give up his earlier beliefs. The same holds true for materialism. Science has proven that matter is not an absolute being, but that it had a beginning. Moreover, it has shown that there is a mind-boggling design in nature. Therefore, materialist scientists studying matter have seen that their theory is inapplicable and that the truth is actually the very opposite of their claim. Interestingly, however, such persons entertain a blind devotion to materialism, exhibiting an astonishing tenacity in holding on to their belief. A Harvard geneticist, Richard Lewington, a well-known materialist and evolutionist, excuses his dogmatic materialism in these words. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a materialist explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, so we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Here Lewington actually depicts the mindset of all materialists. As he acknowledges, materialists first subscribe to the materialist ideology above all else, and then look for evidence to support their ideology. That is to say, materialism is not a conclusion materialists have arrived at through scientific research, but a prejudice they impose upon science. The same idea is embodied in the words of another evolutionist as well. In one of his books, the renowned evolutionist Robert Shapiro states his commitment to the theory of evolution as such. Some future day may yet arrive when all reasonable chemical experiments run to discover a probable origin for life have failed unequivocally. Further, new geological evidence may indicate a sudden appearance of life on the Earth. Finally, we may have explored the universe and found no trace of life, or process leading to life elsewhere. In such a case, some scientists might choose to turn to religion for an answer. Others, however, myself included, would attempt to sort out the surviving, less probable scientific explanations in the hope of selecting one that was still more likely than the remainder. What Shapiro means when he says scientific explanations is actually materialist explanations. This blind devotion to materialism has led Shapiro and thousands of others like him to subscribe to a fanatical disbelief. What they are actually saying is, no matter what the evidence is presented, we will not believe in God. More interestingly, this malady is not peculiar to the current materialists alone. In the Quran, God reveals important knowledge about these people who have resolved to remain disbelievers. For instance, the Egyptians who said, "No matter what kind of sign you bring to bewitch us, we will not believe you," to the prophet Moses, who showed them a number of miracles, had the same predisposition as the materialists of today. In Surah An'am, verse 109, God refers to these people in this way. They have sworn by God with their most earnest oaths that if a sign comes to them, they would believe. Say, the signs are in God's control alone. What will make you realize that even if a sign did come, they would still not believe? The program you have been listening to was inspired by the works of Harum Yahya, the renowned author whose works on political, faith-related, and scientific issues have changed many people's outlook on life. All of his works are available online on his official homepage at www.harumyahya.com. Please keep tuning in to this channel for further episodes of this program.